take a wife for thyself, procreate, make your children, and build strong Jews.
What do people really know about the laws of the system we live in?
Do we have to be at war all the time?
Even if we wipe out our enemies, there's still a lot of work to do between us.
The Jewish people, no matter what we've been through, we've managed to pull out and thrive and continue to teach our children.
At a very expensive cost.
At a very expensive cost.
Why is it not implied to all of us, at least Jews? Why
even Jews aren't perfect. There's a new understanding of what it means to be a Jew since October 7th, even among those people who never felt connected.
The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality?
And we're back with the Jew Function. How's it going?
Hi, friend. Good. Good to be
good.
Back.
Good. I like it. Yes. People asking me, you know, when I ask people in Israel, how's it going? People say, well, what do you want me to say? You know, there's a war going on. And it's true. I guess it's, we take every day, you know, a little bit at a time. Sometimes thinking about the future too much is a little, you know, it could be a little off-putting. Because I don't see, you know, we talked about it. I don't see like a really happy ending anytime soon. There's a lot of work to be done. Like even if we wipe out our enemies, let's say, for example, there's still a lot of work to do between us. So it's not like, you know, we can just wipe off Hamas and get back to
like have a regular life. It's like you also have to be able to just integrate everything. Fighting. There's a lot of power. There's a lot of energy. There's a lot of momentum. There's a lot of goal. And then, okay, but do we have to be at war all the time? Can we figure out how to put all of those powers into a good life?
Well, if you ask some people, they'll say that war is an inevitable part of life. If you ask us,
always has been.
Exactly. And even in the, you know, looking back thousands of years in the Bible, it's always this, you know, a little bit of time off and then war, and a little bit of time off and then war. As if war is part of a rite of passage, something that kind of beckons us to ask questions and to change our attitude and to get, as we discussed it, to get, you know, inducted into the nation, so to speak. And I don't know if we need it. I mean, maybe
like
we'll
fraternity hazing.
Yeah, exactly.
For each generation.
Oh, you survived? Great. Now I can have your startup company. It's kind of like, but also, you know, we're kind of, you know, we're optimists. So, you know, I think our viewers, our listeners know it by now. And I'll just say that if you're listening to the Jew Function, you know, if you have been following it, you know what we're about to some extent. And we're asking, I'm going to ask, make this plea again to really, if you're listening, even if you're listening to the first 5 minutes and then you just check out the little clips that we make, that's fine too. Give us a like, share it, subscribe. We're kind of getting shadow banned left and right, and it's tough to get the message out. Our last episode actually got over 30,000 views on Twitter, so that's good news, and we may start posting more of them on Twitter. But let's not stop, because we do believe we need to broaden this conversation as much as possible. So we need every click, every like. I'll just say our guest is she lives in Israel. She's from New Jersey, but she moved to Israel. She made Aliyah when she was 18, if I'm not mistaken, and she lives in Israel. She's actually in the same milieu as some of our other guests, you know, Hanale and David Lang, and you might even know them. But she's there. She's a writer. She's a mother. She's a writer. She has been writing extensively, but a lot of different topics. It's a lot of work on the, you know, CDC and FDA and all that. But I think everything changed on the 7th, like it did for many of us. And I asked Perplexity who she is. It said that she's involved in selling iced coffee, slushy, and fresh popcorn for Shabbat. So we'll hear about that. Let's give a warm welcome to Etana Hecht.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. So some of your information was correct and some of it a little outdated.
Well, I asked the AI, so, you know, please correct. So give us a quick, actually, so we get to know you too, because we didn't really get to talk much before. So Tell us your life story in 5 minutes or less.
Sure. Well, I'm happy to hear that AI is not the be all and end all, because that was not completely correct. But more or less, I grew up in New Jersey, as you said. At age 18, after high school, I made Aliyah. I basically knew all through high school that once I spent my year in yeshiva in Israel after high school, that I wouldn't be back to New Jersey, ever, pretty much. And I told my parents I'm staying in Israel, and in the biggest blessing on earth, they came to visit me during my year in Hanukkah. And while they were here, they actually signed on a house, and I brought them with me. So we all made Aliyah, and we're all here together, which is amazing. Yeah.
Wow. See, Seth, it's possible.
So yeah, we've been here 20 years. The slushies and popcorn is like probably about 15 years ago when my husband and I were newlyweds, and we literally just bought a little slushy machine to like sell to the kids on the block. I guess Google picked that up from somewhere or another with our advertising. Besides for that, so I've been a writer actually not that long. I only started writing in 2021 as a response to my frustration towards the government responses towards COVID. I wasn't very happy with how it was going, and everybody in my real life was very sick of hearing me kvetch about it all day. So I was like, fine, I'll write it down, and anybody who wants to read it can read it. I didn't expect anybody to read it, but apparently people, you know, took to it, and I got a nice subscribers following. I worked for a company called Daily Clout for a while. It's Dr. Naomi Wolf's website. She does new media, I would say. It's just like she's in the new media field. And I worked there for shortly under a year. And then I decided I just want to be a housewife with a blog again, instead of a full-time editor for a.
What's the conclusion that people don't trust the government's medical advice? And
My conclusion were that if we want to get into that, was that the COVID vaccines never made much sense to me. The restrictions never made much sense to me. It was kind of obvious that like once the government's telling you need to wear a mask when you walk into a restaurant, but when you sit down, it's fine to take it off. That kind of like disqualifies them from knowing what they're talking about or having to listen to them at all. So
is everything else
advice from the government?
Continue.
I was about to ask, is everything else making sense, and only this is not making sense?
You know what? It's the first thing that like opened my eyes to like, maybe this doesn't make so much sense. I also had a major, major issue with, you know, your entire social world and your work world and your school world being blocked out to you unless you took what was absolutely an experimental drug at the time. So yeah. I had a major issue with that. I didn't understand how libertarians, liberals, anyone who was for any sort of personal freedom or autonomy could kind of be on that side of things. And I felt very alone because it seemed like there weren't many people who saw things that way. So then once I started writing, I guess you could say I found my people in terms of the people who personal freedom was really the top of their list, medical freedom. It also made me look at the whole medical industrial complex in a completely different way, including how we treat our own health and our own medical decisions as individuals. When-
This crowd, maybe libertarians, I don't know how you'd call them, but people who say, I want to educate myself and make my decisions, and I'm not interested in kind of some kind of medical tyranny telling me what to inject in myself and all that, right? So that puts this whole crowd of people that begin to listen to you, right, or agree with you. Then when the Jew thing comes up, does that group get split in half? And then like, because usually...
That was crazy. So yes, that's exactly what happened. And it just, first of all, as soon as October 7th happened, my entire Substack, which is where I write, completely shifted. I haven't written about anything medical since October 7th. I completely shifted to writing about Israel and just how I was feeling, because that's what my blog is for. It's for how I'm feeling. And I even wrote, if you don't like this new shift I'm taking, feel free to unsubscribe. Like this is for me, and that's how it is. So I instantly lost hundreds of subscribers with every post since then. I just dropped and dropped and dropped. And look, in my opinion, it's just the trash taking itself out at this point, because I was getting also really anti-Semitic, really horrible comments. And then my whole list of people, I recently went down the list of people that I've actually interviewed or interacted with on a one-to-one basis. I would say almost 50% are on the complete opposite side of the Israel-Palestine thing. And just one thing I would want to say, you said people who were listening to me, it wasn't me. Like, it was me taking information from many doctors and scientists who were very much being shut out of the conversation, but they had a very different view from the mainstream, like government, medical, industrial view of COVID.
Not getting into too many details, but what would be the qualities of the people who were interested in the things you were saying? Not in the details about vaccines and stuff like that, but for example, they weren't just sheep to follow whatever says in the media, right? Like, what are a couple qualities of all of the people who were reading you before October 7th?
I really would say that the top quality, the top priority of theirs would be freedom, personal autonomy and freedom.
So then there's a whole group that says they're looking for personal autonomy and freedom. That splits take the entire population, split it in half or however, and say this group over here is interested in autonomy and freedom. Now that group got split after October 7th. So what was the split there? Amongst people who are into personal autonomy and freedom.
So what I noticed is that mix of the people who had freedom at the top of the list was a huge mix of conservatives and Democrats, however you want to call them, Republicans and Democrats, left-wingers and right-wingers. The further split that came once I started talking about Israel, split between the people who were previously left and previously right. The people who were previously right, for the most part, besides for your hardcore America first, just because they don't care about anything but America, and they're at least consistent. Like, they don't want to fund Ukraine. They also don't want to fund Israel. So that was like, it was less of an anti-Israel and anti-Jew thing, and more of a, you know, America first thing. But the real Israel haters, the people who just had this like seething hatred towards anything I was saying, were the people who were left-wing before the medical freedom movement, which I found really interesting. I would say self-described leftists, meaning these were people who felt completely abandoned by their left-wing Democrat movement when their entire circle were embracing mandates, mask mandates and vaccine mandates. And so they felt abandoned, and they kind of found a home within the conservative libertarian crew, but they were still self-described Democrats and left-wingers politically. And then after the whole Israel thing happened, like that split. That was the split. The self-described Democrats and leftists are all over Twitter and all over Substack, and just not being able to see from the Israel side of things. They're very pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas almost.
You say freedom and autonomy. How would you define freedom? I'm curious. Like, what does it mean?
Honestly, having the government stay out of our lives as much as humanly possible. I understand that we live in a society and there needs to be some sort of cohesive set of rules, but I felt that the physical demands of our bodies, of covering our faces and covering and injecting ourselves with something supposedly for the benefits of other people, even though they never proved that and they still never proved that. And in fact, we've found out that the opposite has been true in many cases. That was just, for me, like so far overreach that we crossed any semblance of freedom shortly after COVID broke out. I mean, I would watch people measuring 100 meters from their front door because that's what the government said to do. And to me, I was just like, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. And I'm not going to buy into that just because that's what they're saying.
So to extend that idea, we do subscribe to many other government mandated aspects of our lives. I mean, you send, I don't know about you, but most people send their kids to school. They have no other choice. They send their kids to school, they usually don't have much to pick from. I mean, there's several schools in their district, right, that you can pick from, but they're mostly all more or less the same, more or less. I mean, occasionally you have a school that has a slightly different bent, right? But for the most part, it's, you know, government mandated programs. So you take your child, take him out of the house, put him to be programmed, and not just the material in school, just the whole atmosphere, right? It's a very specific way.
Absolutely.
of creating a human, and we put him there. Why don't we rebel against that? Why just COVID? You know,
funny you say that, because I actually did take my children out of school as soon as schools reopened and they were demanding that my 7-year-old wear a mask. I said, I see that as child abuse. I see that as major overreach. I don't see that her covering her mouth with the mask is going to help anybody, especially not herself. And my job is to take care of her. And I didn't send her back to school, and we started homeschooling. And I saw there were major other benefits to that. Like you said, like there's definitely benefits to being in school, and there were many benefits to letting her experience the world outside of school for a few years as well. So I, at least I'm consistent with that in terms of the freedom aspect of it. But even the mandate to send your child to school, and I did it all legally. I got my permission for chinuch betit, which is how you say homeschooling in Israel. But even beyond all of that, I don't see how like sending your child to school is the same as someone saying you have to cover your face with a mask. Not everybody saw that as extreme as I did. I suffered terribly when I wore for the short amount of time I complied with the mask mandates. I did suffer a lot. And I understand some people didn't see it as a big deal, but to me, covering your face is covering everything. It's covering your essence, your smile, your soul, your ability to interact with other people. I just saw that as so much more detrimental than using common sense. If you're not feeling well, stay home, like we've always done throughout all of human
history. Was there a Jew aspect to it?
Not really.
No?
Not really. So, I mean, ironically, I think...
No, not about you. I mean, with the followers, when it came... When, like, because the COVID thing probably... You can bunch all humanity into the same basket, and some were against the mandates, some were for it, and probably had Jews on both sides.
Absolutely.
Right. So there was no definition around Jews, although some people said that, you know, Pfizer was a Jewish conspiracy, you know, like, I don't know.
Right. No. I've heard all those.
But the thing that split people into this very, very separate, these separate camps had nothing to do with being a Jew. Really, right?
It was I would say in general, no. I have two points to make that are not really related, but to each other, but both related to your question. So for the first, I would say that the very religious Jews in Israel, I had a newfound respect for them for the first time during COVID, because I saw the way that they really stood strong, and they're like, we're not going to allow these kind of these government mandates to change how we educate our children, change how we learn Torah, change how we go to synagogue and pray. We're just going to continue to operate as we were. And if they want to overreach, I mean, that's kind of, they'll have to face the consequences of that. And for the first time, I felt super comfortable shopping in ultra Orthodox supermarkets, because I wasn't the only one not wearing a mask. Nobody was wearing a mask because it didn't make sense to any of us. And I felt almost a kinship with the ultra Orthodox Jews. On the other side, when this split happened between my followers or my connections, my contacts, I find a lot of the left wingers who are pro the medical freedom movement, but anti-Israel after October 7th are Jewish. A lot of those left wingers who became anti-Israel and subsequently unfollowed me or came after me or messaged me to say, you know, that I don't understand how you're on this side of this, but you were on that side of that. A lot of those people are Jewish, the hardcore left wing Jewish, I guess, anti-establishment Democrats.
Yeah, we know Jews come in all shapes and sizes. We know enough about that. So. Okay, so I think we have a nice picture of your somewhat rebellious spirit, which is good.
I guess it's funny. I haven't spoken about this in a while because it almost feels irrelevant since October 7th. It was my passion for so long because I was so passionate about trying to tell people, like, you do have autonomy. You can choose what you're going to do.
I see a lot of similarities, though, actually, in the storylines between the two situations, even though the details are very different.
I think it's interesting because you say, you know, people need to be able to choose and this and this and that, but we keep coming up against this concept in our research and looking at the problem of anti-Semitism and Jewish hatred and all of that is something that's been a running theme throughout history. And one of our main points is that we live in a system, like a natural system, that's governed by different laws, like any natural system, and for the most part, people, we're walking around in the system not knowing the laws, as a result, we make a lot of mistakes. We harm ourselves, we harm others, we get into all kinds of trouble as humanity at large. And part of that, what we say is us, the Jews, we're also we're not reading the system correctly. So on the one hand, as you say, think for yourself, try to do the research, and don't let people just enforce all kinds of things on you and all that. But on the other hand, what do people really know about the laws of the system we live in? And I'm segueing into the next question to you is like, what do you think is the deal with anti-Semitism? What's that about? Do you see? Are you from the camp who sees it as a, you know, just another thing, as just something in the, you know, in humanity? It's a feature. It's a bug in the system. We have to learn to live with it, and that's it. There's nothing to do about it. Or are you with the side that says, well, maybe there's something going on here. Maybe something is out of balance, out of whack. Maybe we're not seeing something correctly, and it is not accidental, not random, not, you know, any of those things, but there's some rhyme and reason to it that we are not seeing.
It's a great question. I feel like it's too big. It's bigger than any of us.
I don't think anyone else is doing what we're doing. And, yeah, and that's exactly it. No, nobody can comprehend what we're talking about. Who would even say that anti-Semites have anything valuable to say without saying we're anti-Semitic or we're self-hating Jews? But there's something that everybody's missing in this whole picture. And the reason why the solution is so close is because we're not waiting for anyone else to change. We're not waiting for laws to be enacted. We're not waiting for a new politician to get elected. The answer is way closer than everybody thinks.
Like us, hit the bell thing on the YouTube so you can get a notification when a new episode is up. Well, this is the Jew Function, and let's get back to our guest.
Great question. I feel like it's too big. It's bigger than any of us. And I'd actually love to hear like just a quick summary of what your research has led you to. In short, I would say that I think it's almost a given because it's always been here. So why do we think that our generation is different? I don't know. I think that, and I can give my reasons for why I think it's a given. I think a lot of it has to do with human nature and the Jewish people, and both of those things, when they tie together, you have the Jewish people who have been this strong, small force for so many years. And what binds us together and what brings us through and carries us from generation to generation are our very strong values that place a high important level of importance on family, on education, on hard work, on religion, on being together, and on our history and learning about all that. And those things, especially family, I would say with family at the top, those things are a recipe for success. And so, there are so people who will always hate the people who are successful.
You take the Jews and you put them into one basket, right? They're into family, they're into this, right? So that's how the world, you know, also groups us into one group. But then there's this other thing that happens where that group gets split in half, you know, just like we talked about around the vaccine and around October 7th, like even within the Jews, there's a split, right? I know even in Beit Shemesh, there's a you know, things happen where maybe the Haredim are on one side, the ultra-Orthodox are on the other side, and the secular on the other side. You know, what kind of clothes are appropriate in this market, and what kind of, where you can drive and when you can't drive. And so there's also a huge division within the Jews. Have you seen that?
Yeah, absolutely. But that's, again, probably also part of our DNA, like two Jews, three opinions, right? Two Jews, three synagogues. Pretty much most of those people who identify as Jews and their Jewish identity is a core part of who they are, those aspects that lead to success, whatever, you know, however you define success, for us, it means we're still here. Success means we're still here. And we're kind of outsized proportionally to our numbers in terms of leadership positions around the world and building successful companies around the world. And while you might have your Jews who disagree on this or that, the people who hate the Jews are going to put us all in one basket. They're not gonna differentiate.
All right. So that's you know, you kind of walked right into the trap.
Oh no.
No, okay.
You caught me.
I mean, you follow the breadcrumbs correctly, as did we. I mean, it's not, you know, this is a true, you know, this is a correct approach. The question that came to us was, are we really going to be the people who are only going to be defined through the negative? Like, who are the Jews? Those that everybody tried to kill. Those that are still here. Those that survived against all odds. They're like, this is fine, but what kind of definition is that? But that's the thing. You say part of it. I'm going to ask you, is there a definition that's not defined by the negative? Because I haven't seen one yet. We've interviewed a lot of people. No one has been able to tell us what defines a Jew from the positive. A lot of great, you know, long-winded stories about trying to do this to the Jews and thinking the Jews are one thing but another, but not a definition that is uniquely positive.
I mean, I would say that the ingredients that I mentioned before that create this recipe for success as a whole, you know, overall, which is the strong ties to family and history and our tradition and the Torah, I think those are very positive aspects that make up the Jewish people and individual Jews as well.
Are you religious?
I grew up like Orthodox. My parents actually were not religious growing up, but they became Orthodox, and I grew up Orthodox in New Jersey. My husband and I kind of like, you know, find our own path, but we're within the Orthodox community.
But you're not like Haredi or ultra Orthodox.
No, this is not a wig.
So there's like ultra Orthodox, and then there's what you are, traditional or, you know, observant things.
Yeah, modern Orthodox.
Then there's, you know, there's this whole spectrum, right?
Yeah. Honestly, I would say for me, Israel to me was always the central part of being a Jew. The fact that we had this beautiful ancient land with thousands of years of tangible history here, that to me just connects the Jews, which is why I felt such a pull to come here at such a young age.
Is there some connection between, because I think that you take the whole spectrum of Jews in Israel, let's just say, for example, because the United States is a whole other story, and abroad is a whole other story. There's from ultra-Orthodox all the way to some kind of observance of something, or at least respect of it and something. And then there's some other group to the side, which is like, we're just like the Germans, we're just like the Irish, we're just another people. They have no connection.
Assimilationists, you know.
Yeah, but in Israel. Right.
I would say the number of those have shrunk dramatically since October 7th. You can tangibly feel it, how the people who before they're Israeli like another person's Irish. I think that there's a new understanding of what it means to be a Jew since October 7th, even among those people who never felt connected. You could see that with the amount of tzitzit that their soldiers were requesting, even the non-religious soldiers, to wear out in the field because they wanted something tangible to connect their Judaism. But yes, of course we have those people. Those people exist. And some of those people exist just by nature of being born in Israel. So they're Israeli and they never really connected or they were never taught. And so, you know, but they're still part of Am Yisrael just like the rest of us. And
so how would you explain this really improportional amount of attention that Israel and the Jews get in the world? I mean, seemingly you describe a nice group of people, have a rich history and all of that, but why this unusual place within the network of humanity?
That's the $1 million question. It's terrifying to me. I always used to say I hate when Israel's in the news. I hated it. And then October 7th came and it's like, we can't get out of the news. We're not getting out of the news anytime soon. And it's just this outsized attention is very, very scary. Why it exists, I don't know. It's okay. $1 million question. And I think that I would say is that, listen, we were a bunch of like scrappy survivors who took a desert and created a thriving metropolis on an ancient land. So there are the people who themselves are successful and themselves value hard work, and they know what it means to have hard work, so they will respect other people who have worked hard and created something out of nothing. And then you'll have the people who, for whatever reason of their own and whatever their circumstances, they are not as successful. They don't understand how to create and how to build in the way that clearly the Jewish people do know how to do. And then that overwhelming jealousy will just turn into a seething hatred, and they will look for anything to be able to pin that on. So that's really how I see it in the big picture. And that's how it's been throughout, because you're not, if only a small percentage of people can be the most, let's say the most successful or very successful, meaning the whole world is not ever going to be completely successful and or creators or builders. It's never been like that. You've never had every right. single nation be able to absolutely thrive. But the Jewish people, no matter what we've been through, we've managed to pull out and thrive and continue to teach our children.
At a very expensive cost.
At a very expensive cost. And we pay the cost in every generation.
So on that, I guess the next question would be like, how do you explain the fact that, let's say everything you said is fine, is true, but you'd expect that something would change, meaning either we continue to grow and thrive and grow in numbers as well, and really, right, because we've been around the longest, we should be a lot of us, even with the Holocaust and all of that, still the numbers haven't changed for millennia, very small number relative to all of humanity. And not only that, we haven't been wiped out, which is also a mystery if you think about it. I mean, life is so precarious, so many other small groups that have been, you know, rooted in their land for thousands of years just disappeared, you know, ancient tribes, Americas, North and South and the East, and happens all the time. Entire nations disappear, not the Jews. How do you explain that then?
For the religious or believers among us, I would say that God said we are his chosen people.
Wait, who?
He gave us the, what, sorry, what?
I said who said?
God.
Okay, so like, there's a new character in the story here. We have to.
There's a new character in the story, and I absolutely tie the existence of God to our story because, like you said, nobody else has given an answer. So if there are no other answers, then maybe God is the answer, and he has kept us alive, although we haven't grown, like you said, although part of that's due to genocide. Part of that's due to
just because he's a great, just because he's like the strongest God in the universe, or like why? What would be the reason to keep this group of alive? Just because we lucked out and we got a good God, and the other guys, their God wasn't as great as ours, and so they didn't.
Maybe. And this isn't going to be politically correct to say, but I remember being a little girl. Yeah, I know.
We don't care. We're already shadow banned, so it can't.
Good. But I remember being a little girl in New Jersey, and I would look, or like when we were just out in public or whatever, and I would look around, and I would actively think to myself, and I was little, maybe 9 or 10, I actively think to myself, I am so lucky that I was born a Jew. I'm so lucky that I was born into a Jewish family. I just looked around and I saw that the families in my community were mostly intact, as opposed to what we would see in the broader community of public schools.
Where, in your Jewish community, the families are mostly
in my
intact.
Religious, small Jewish community.
Yeah, less divorce, absolutely.
Much less divorce. I knew maybe one or two girls from divorced families growing up, and that's a tangible difference from the general public, which is, 50% divorce rate?
Yes.
I think right there, you can explain the difference between a strong, successful community and strong, successful children.
Is that because we got a good God? I just want to, I'm being a little, you know, like,
it's totally
I just want to get to the root of it.
Maybe it's because, and you know, maybe some people should have been divorced and they didn't because of the stigma or whatever it is. And it wasn't the best thing for those in those individual cases. But as a whole, our God, and therefore our religion, puts such a high priority on family, an active high priority on family, such a high priority that we are forced to sit together and eat together at least 2 meals a week, at least, right, if not more. And you just don't have that in the broader world, especially now.
Is there a feeling of that this God wants something from us?
Yeah, maybe I'll refine the question, because you said ego, a little too harsh. You know, speaking of this
who's
God,
your God, and what does he want from you?
Yeah, speaking of this God that you mentioned, that a lot has been written on him and by him, or at least, you know, his message to his people. Is there something that we can maybe learn from what God is saying to us? If you follow that, you know, is there something hidden in this, you know, in the text, for example, that we're overlooking? Like, are we missing something? Because God didn't say, if we follow the God idea, which is fine, by the way, just for everybody who's listening, you could say God and his commandments, or you could say nature and its laws. It's the same. You break one, you get punished. If you keep it, you can thrive. So it's almost like this. You could say the laws of God or the commandments of nature, and it's almost interchangeable if you think about it. And we have this almost direct messaging that's been coming down, right, from God or from the system we're in. But are we missing something? Why we keep getting slapped around so terribly?
By other nations,
by ourselves, or by God? I don't know. I mean, you've seen what happened until October 7th in Israel, for example. You've been here, and you see what's happening already. It's reawakening already. You start to feel like the. You know, yeah, the guys fighting on the front, they're still holding on to it, and they're seeing those miracles, let's call it, but you know, back, you know, in Jerusalem and then Tel Aviv, it's back to business. What's going on? Maybe you can give us a clue. We're not reading some of the fine print.
So I probably can't give you a clue, but I would go back to just saying that even if you don't believe in God or you don't believe that he's really a part of the picture, somehow our people have really passed down the same messages generation after generation after generation. And that history becomes so strong that it's itself a force of nature. If you're born into a family that has somewhat of a Jewish identity, it's effort to go against it. It's effort to break away from it.
Right.
If you just move with inertia, then you're just going to become part of the Jewish people. And again, the high impact that we put on family, hard work, education, building, those are all recipes for a successful people, and successful people are not well liked.
By the way, we can argue that point as well, because you can have also positive envy towards someone, right? The kind of envy that pulls you out of your little place and makes you positively competitive and try harder, right? And all
absolutely
that kind of
stuff. I think that exists, you know, a lot as well among us, with each other even.
Exactly. I'm curious, since you, again, you grew up in a house that's more religious, is there one commandment, one law that sort of supersedes all the other laws? One
class? I guess there's three. Yeah, there's three, and that would be Shabbat.
What's the top one? What's the highest one?
Shabbat.
Really?
Yeah, because that brings the families into the, in that. Okay, I want to think for 1 second before I word this properly. But Shabbat and the Shabbat meals actively brings the people together in a way that creates this environment of family, of togetherness, of people. And I think that Shabbat, like, there's a saying that you keep Shabbat and Shabbat will keep you. And I really believe that really holds true to me. Even just that once a week or twice a week family togetherness has such a major, major impact on individuals.
Okay. Yeah, so that's one. You want to ask about the Shabbat?
Seth, you know what? I like this concept because
great.
From what I remember is that like Shabbat is a taste of the final goal of like the end of the whole process.
Of the next world, together. They say. It's
a taste like of the work, the work is done. You know, like you're not supposed to work. You did all the work. Now everyone's together. Like you said, all those warm feelings. We're eating. We're singing. We're praising God. We're being together. There's nowhere to go. There's nothing to accomplish.
There's nothing that can replace. There's nothing that replaces that. There's no movie you can watch that can give you those same feelings.
The question I have is, it sounds such a great premise. And I do agree wholeheartedly that, you keep us. A strong family is the smallest social unit, right? And you start with that, you build on it. Amazing. How come so many people, so many Jewish people are actively, you know, against that concept of Shabbat? I remember growing up, I grew up in a secular family, and on the one hand, we all enjoyed it, we could all feel it was in the air. On the other hand, people speaking to those freedoms he described, right? I'm free to get in my car and drive. You know,
you are. You are free to get in your car and drive.
I know. I'm making a point. Yeah. No, but still, there are people who are still very much kind of like not seeing that inner qualities that you describe. They're only seeing the limitations of Shabbat. Why is that?
I don't want to sound like I don't even want to use the word condescending, but I think that it takes a certain level of like slow maturity and appreciation for the world that you kind of get with age. When I was younger and my kids were little, I hated Shabbat. It was so hard. It was so hard to wake up with my babies at 5 o'clock in the morning and not be able to distract anybody with television or go on my phone. It was just like hours of just me and a baby alone in a room until other people in the neighborhood would start waking up. And then as my kids got older, as much as Shabbat was hard for me when they were young, that's how much I appreciate it now that they're older and that it's this time where everybody's all busy during the week. And the minute I light those Shabbat candles, I feel this like entire deep breath that I don't get the rest of the week. It's like everything's done. Now we just get to sit and enjoy each other. And I also love, I mean, even more important now than it used to be is the whole technology aspect of things where we're off screens for 25 hours, where my entire neighborhood, you don't even need to make plans in advance. It's just everybody's outside wandering in and out of each other's homes. It's almost like transporting ourselves back 100 years to the way like a community lives
or the
and a
future.
Family lives.
Transporting humanity into the future.
I think that even non-religious people should like keep a level of Shabbat because it breaks up your week. It distinguishes one week from the next. It gives you a little bit of a breather and it turns you off from the news for 25 hours, which is so necessary. Why do people push back against it? Because they see those restrictions as restrictive instead of a gift that allows you to breathe somehow. And you don't have to take it. Like you said, you have the choice to get in your car and drive. I had times where I was very resentful of it.
That was part of the argument, especially here in Israel. I mean, in New York, you don't feel it because, you know, you're religious, you do your thing, then you have cars driving through your neighborhood. But in Israel, you get in the wrong neighborhood, you can get stoned sometimes. So I think people were kind of reacting to that reaction. But the idea of Shabbat, the concept, that's a great practical thing. And Seth, I'm surprised we haven't like had that as a practical takeaway.
You know, there's a difference. It really true. And I'm really inspired how you're describing it because it's so wonderful, all of these benefits of just being with the family and all that. But there's a huge, again, like it seems to be the theme of this show, like you take a group and then you split, and if you want that because of a good reason, because you want to be together with people you love and you appreciate turning the news off and going to the family's house and come over, you'll eat something here, then we'll go to your place, let the kids all play, that's one thing. If someone's coming to you and forcing it on you, that's like the medical tyranny again. That's like the government again coming and telling me what to do. So it's like,
absolutely.
Are we going to force people to taste the future great,
wonderful
world?
Can we teach them about that somehow?
We're forcing you to taste how good life is. You know, that doesn't feel right.
It doesn't work. It doesn't work also. You can't coerce
people.
And
let's look at Chabad, which is probably the most successful cure of organization that helps show people the beauty of Judaism. Their whole thing is you never force, you invite, you show how beautiful it is. And I agree with you, when you're forced to do something, you're resentful of it. And I had plenty of that resentment for myself with various aspects of Judaism through growing up and then even as a young adult and now an older adult. But within a family, let's say, a parent absolutely has the right to bring up their child however they say they see fit and impose any rules within reason. That's not somewhat abusive or anything, of course, but impose any sort of framework for their child to grow up in. So any individual couple, any individual family absolutely does have the right to create that environment and have the expectations of their kids to follow suit as long as they live in the house.
Maybe even responsibility to create something like that.
A responsibility because you're part of our family and you have a right to bring up your family however you see fit. On a broader term, like, do I agree that there shouldn't be, that, you know, buses should be outlawed across Israel? Not necessarily. Do I think that religious neighborhoods, there shouldn't be petitions to to bring buses? Absolutely. I see it as you know, as much of a live and let live as we possibly can on both ends. Meaning, don't try and like force your secularism on the religious communities. And for the most part, we do split into religious and secular communities. And for the most part, people do split into an Anglo enclave here and a South African enclave here and a Russian enclave here, because that's human nature. As much as people would love to say diversity is our strength, it's not, you know, it's not always the case when you try to mix too many cultures together to live together. You want to live with people who share the same values as you, and that's fine.
Yeah, no, that's true. So that leads us to, so you said there are three things. So Shabbat is one, that the concept is great. I love it. If you're listening and you're not Jewish, maybe give it a try, just as a concept, as an idea of something that could, you know, strengthen the family, the community, and just the appreciation of the week. There's so many self-help things and do this and do that, but here's something that's been, you know, been tried for thousands of years. Give it a try. All right, one. What are two other things? What's the next thing? You said three. Jew function is really it's a desperate, I guess, desperate attempt to change something about the rise in anti-Semitism that doesn't seem to go away. And looking at history, usually ends with something terrible before we reach relative quiet again. But we don't want to reach something terrible. We want to do it now. So that's why we're doing this podcast. And if you like this, also consider leaving a small contribution on our Patreon channel. Right, we both have day jobs, by the way, so we're not hoping to make money from this. Are we hoping to see some change of heart?
Any funds are used to get this out there, to get this to people. We consider this the same way you go out every day to get money to feed your family, put a roof over your head. This is also critically important to our future, to our safety, to a good world, not only for Jews, but for everyone.
Well, this is the Jew function, and let's get back to our guest. All right, one, what are two other things? What's the next thing? You said three.
So I say three only because I kind of have imbibed in me that if you are considered Orthodox, that means you keep these three things. So, okay. And in my opinion, Shabbat is the most important of those for the reasons I already outlined. The second one would be kashrut, and that is to keep kosher. And that's because food is obviously such a central part of everybody's life. And if you have these dietary restrictions that you share with all of these people who you have a history with, you have shared value with, you have a shared religion with, it means you're going to gravitate towards those people when you eat together, which is such a, again, strong part of our life. It means that when you go on vacation, you're going to find the other Jews in that area because you need to figure out how to eat. So the dietary restrictions, just, it brings Judaism into your life on a consistent basis.
It's more like an easy to recognize signal. It's a signal. Yeah.
It's a social thing.
Social signal. It's a bonding mechanism. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. And then, I'm sure we're gonna get some pushback. My parents love the grew up in Romania. They love the sliced ham, pastrami. You know,
for sure. and you know, my kids will ask my parents like, oh, what did bacon taste like back in the day? If they ever had it, or their relatives.
You can give them bacon bits. You know, those fake.
Oh, sure. We love those, and you know, we love all those things. And then the third one that I just grew up with understanding that this is what makes a person Orthodox versus not Orthodox is Taharat HaMishpacha, which is the laws of family purity. And that a little more complex to go in. I don't really want to go into all of the details of it. It's a very drawn out subject. What's the umbrella principle? The umbrella is that there's certain restrictions between a man and a wife at certain times of the month based on the woman's cycle, and that your entire marriage is, you know, you're almost tied into like the greater world around you in a very, very basic core natural way, like in a natural cycle that it goes on. But on the other hand, I'm going to go into a little more detail for your viewers who might not know. Basically, for a woman, 2 weeks out of the month when she's menstruating, and then for about a week afterwards until she's completely finished, and there's no touching between a man and a wife. And then at the end of that 2-week period, the woman will go to a ritual bath, and be declared allowed to her husband again. And then the next two weeks or however long until she starts her next. Exactly. So it keeps a Jewish relationship and a Jewish marriage extremely fresh and extremely strong because you have that. You don't really, there's no room for boredom.
Right. So if I had to translate these three laws, so again, because we're trying to, we definitely think that as Jews, we are somewhat of an example to people. So I'm trying to translate that to an example that people can maybe take, because
light to the nations, you can
light
say.
To the nations and all of that, right? So you don't need to become Jewish, but maybe something about it. So the Shabbat thing, this separation between the weeks, have a day, disconnect from the screens and from all these other mechanical distractions and technological distractions, electronic distractions around you, and you focus.
I would say disconnect with the screens while connecting with people. Both
right. I mean,
it almost kind of
leaves, it forces it in a nice way. It forces you to, look again at the people around you. Right. Oh, you live here too. And all of that. So there's that. And then number two is these have some sort of an instrument of social bonding, like these dietary restrictions that we have that help you find one another relative ease. Right, without being, it's not like it doesn't somehow, you still can be yourself, let's call it, what it is, but there's this one thing that we all share, so we can it's easy to find one another, so that's important. So it's not this extreme individuation that you lose all connection with others, but there's some aspects that are shared, right? And then again, like the Shabbat thing, and then the last thing is something about also looking at the family unit, things that keep that unit intact and fresh and also tied to the bigger cycles of nature, which I like. So these are all good. I'm surprised you didn't mention the great rule of the Torah, as Rabbi Akiva say. So how come that's not on your list?
V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha?
Yeah.
Ding, 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 ding.
I think that can tie into all three of the things that I mentioned.
I agree, which is why I asked you at the beginning. I said, maybe there's one that's bigger than everything. And it's funny. And again, it's not, castigating you for not thinking of that, but I'm saying that it's funny how we, when we speak to a lot of people, everybody eventually gets to it. But if we speak to a more religious person, they will say, yes, it's there too. We'll get there after we do everything else. And then if there's a non-religious person, they'd be like, yes, it's important to have, you teach your kids, and then you forget about it.
It's like, I have an answer to why it wasn't top of my mind.
Thank God, we've been waiting 300 episodes in, we have an answer. So.
No, for me, individually.
Yeah.
My answer is because I don't see that at all as limited to Jews. I don't see that as limited to being a Jewish thing, and while the other three absolutely are. V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha should be, which is loving your neighbor as you love yourself, should be something that's not limited to Jews. That's a message to spread to everybody. That has
Now, this is not a question to you. Now we're like together, like trying to solve this. Who's God, gave them this and told them to spread it? And who is responsible for spreading this message to the world? And would the world be better if this message was spread?
Yes, and whoever is spreading it are the ones who take it upon themselves to understand that we all need each other, we depend on each other, and that this is a message worthy of being spread. But again, I don't think that's limited to the Jewish people. I'm not going to go over to non-Jewish people and start talking to them about Shabbat and Kashrut and Tahor HaMishpacha. But like, if I, but loving your neighbor as you love yourself, that's easily a topic everybody can instantly relate to, understand, and see the value in.
So if it's so easy, why? Number one, and if you, as you yourself said, they all somehow are all informed by that law. It's the different sort of expressions of that. And there's a reason why it's called the klal. In Hebrew, klal is the one that collects everything, right? It's the collective, the rule, the general rule of everything. And there's a reason, because it is sort of the thing that's behind everything. If what we're asking is if it's so apparent, and to you said, oh, it's so, I didn't even think about it because it's implied. Why is it not implied to all of us, at least Jews who live in Israel, at least, not even the rest of the world? Why
Even
can't
Jews
we?
aren't perfect.
Well, aren't perfect. It's okay, but we almost you know, we almost split the country in half before the
Yeah, and it's not limited. That crosses religious lines all across. You know, the lack of loving your neighbor as yourself.
Yeah.
That crosses all religious lines, all political lines. You'll find the people who just their agenda is more important than anything else across all lines. And why, I don't have an answer. That one's past my peril.
No,
because
it's crazy. It's almost like, you know, we started with this conversation. We're talking about there's all these laws and all these, you know, our commandments, all those things and things that tie us together and things that have ensured our survival also, as you said, but it, you know, with this particular thing, it's almost like we're blind to it somehow. We teach it to our kids. Everybody's teaching that to their kids, but when it comes to you, no. Okay, that's where the buck stops. It's like, you know, on certain conditions, sometimes with certain people, you know.
Listen, if it was too easy, where would the value be? Like, part of it is that you have to work at it.
I agree, but. My biggest concern is, and Seth's as well, but mine is maybe even more palpable because I live in Israel like you, and is that we got to such a opposition from this law. We didn't simply not keep it. We like went against it, right? Diametrically opposite, right? And October 7th happened, and part of the research that Seth and I do. Is just look at history. You just looked at history. Jews have, you know, one of the best recorded histories in all of humanity, and every big calamity was always preceded by a huge disunity. Every single one, all the way up to the Holocaust, there was always tremendous disunity right before a big slap came and be like, "What are you guys doing?" And that's when we saw what's happening as a this is happening, this attack from the outside, we have to respond with unity, whereas we're saying no, we were not united and the world responded with this big slap across the face. We're reversing the cause and effect. That's what we're saying. And not only, you know, we're saying it, we have so many quotes from Jewish sages, they're all saying
I grew up like you. I mean, I grew up in New Jersey in a Jewish community, quasi next to me was a Jewish community. My community wasn't that Jewish, but I thought Hanukkah was just the Greeks trying to come and kill us, right? It wasn't until Leo and I got really deep into the research, and it was actually right in front of us the whole time. It was the Maccabees against the Hellenist Jews. I mean, that's what the real fighting was all about. I was shocked to learn that I just thought. We were just minding our own business and they tried to kill us and then God helped us and we won and then we got a period.
And we eat.
Yeah.
And then again, they tried to kill us and then God helped us. And then like Leo and I are going through this. That's what those first two, those 22 episodes of our show were about. It's like we go through history. It's like
the first temple, the Greeks, the second temple, then, you know, the Middle Ages.
Orim, every time.
Britain and France and Spain and the expulsion. There's always Jew on Jew hatred before.
There's a huge lesson there.
Well, but are we learning it? It's 2,000 years, for God's sake.
We haven't learned it yet. Are we just going to keep doing this cycle over and over?
You're
maybe.
Hopefully going to tell all your people that you're writing to about it so that they can
I'll
know
tell
also.
All of them. Anyone who hasn't unsubscribed to me yet, they'll all know.
I think that we just don't know that. I mean, like I'm like a college educated modern Jew, and I had no idea. I just thought everyone just wanted to kill us for no reason.
As a religious Jew, we definitely learned that growing up. That it was there's a word for it called sinat chinam.
Exactly.
I learned.
So
we learned that growing up.
Yeah, but okay, you learned that, and yet even in the religious communities in Israel, there's plenty of that between different communities. Between
100%.
Your socks is up to here, my socks is down to there. I hate you, right? There's a lot of that. Not to mention towards.
I would say that comes from it. An ignorance or an issue of where you're putting priorities as a community. Like we're all still just humans, and the people who kind of understand that that unity really is more important than how tall your socks are the ones in each generation that have to shout at the top of their lungs and remind people that, no, we have to do this together. And listen, I, for the last 20 years living in Beit Shemesh, I literally live on the line between the Haredi neighborhood and the not Haredi neighborhood. Now, my neighborhood is also religious, but we're not Haredi. And there's a physical barrier. There's like a street with like trees going down it. And that's the physical barrier between the two neighborhoods. And there's always the people in both neighborhoods who take out their flags and they reach across the aisle, they reach across the street, and they create initiatives to try and bring our two communities together. And those are the people who get it.
After October 7th,
yeah.
No, but after October 7th, did the community come together?
In subtle ways, in that you see all of a sudden the Haredi community jumping in to war efforts. And you see the non-Haredi communities welcoming it with open arms instead of going back to the same old, like, we do army, you don't fight. I haven't seen much of that.
How, we have to, we're sort of amazing, you know, the hour just flew by.
Flies, wow.
And I feel like we're just getting to know you, which is great. And so as we tell everybody, you're in our circle and, you know, expect an invitation to the next live panel when it happens.
I'm enjoying this very much.
Good. I wonder, you probably heard of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, right? Which a lot of people ascribe a lot of the damage in the modern era to that particular publication. And we thought, why don't we, repossess that and, own that, actually. Okay, so if everybody believes that there's some protocols, let us write the real protocols. You know, what are the protocols that we want to be known for? Not the ones that this weird lie that people bought into. So we asked people along the way, like, if we were writing them today, and that, love your friend as yourself, your neighbor as yourself, that was the first one. What would you add to it?
Honestly, I would say that people should put their biggest priority in life should be building a family.
But it's phrased it like a principle to the world.
That's hard.
A protocol, part of the protocols.
Part of the protocols would be take a wife for thyself, procreate, make your children, and build strong new Jews for the next generation. That would be my protocol. Really just a heavy emphasis on family and the deep understanding that at the end of the day, it's almost the only thing that matters.
So that sounds great, not just for Jews, but for everyone. Like, that should be.
I think if everybody focused on that, yeah, we'd have a world peace instead of like trying to see what the people who are different from you are doing and hating them for it on all ends.
That's amazing. Seth, if you have some closing words, I just posted in the chat a little quote from Yehuda Ashlag Baha Sulam, who wrote the commentary in the Book of Zohar and a few other things. A tremendous thinker that we often quote here. And if you could read that, that would be phenomenal, if you don't mind. But Seth, any final words of wisdom after this?
We're very happy to get to know you, first of all.
Thank you.
Yeah. Ditto. So our goal is to get to the root of why. Really, our goal is to help bring a world of like love and goodness. That's what we want. We see this thing called anti-Semitism that the nations are pressuring us, and it's been with us for thousands of years. It's something that we need to deal with. We started dealing with it way long before October 7th, and now it's in the news. We realize that we need to attach into the circle all of these that like what happened at Sinai, is that the whole nation has to be there. We have to agree on this thing. So we really value being able to have this conversation and being able to include you in the conversation. It's great to hear your opinions on all these things. And I think what stood out, this kind of thread from the beginning when we talked about COVID, and the COVID mandates all the way to where we are, was that there's a group, and then there's a split in that group, and then there's another group, and there's a split in that group, and there's another group, and there's a split in that group. And we have to, just like our God started with this small group of people, and then from that group of people, if they can get it right, or even as you are saying here from your protocol, the family, start raising and teaching love here, and then they will want to be and marry people who can have love and teach their kids. And then those kids, now you're 20 family members deep or something by the second generation, and they're all teaching love. So same way, like with this nation, we feel that this small nation needs to have this quality of v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, of love your neighbor as yourself. And then we need to spread it and spread it and spread it. And we hope that that you also enjoyed being with us. And
amen, absolutely.
That hopefully that if something sticks with you from our conversation, that the unity of the Jewish people is our secret weapon.
I couldn't agree more. I love it. And yeah, keep spreading your message. It's great.
So here's the quote for you. It's in the chat. Let's hear it.
You want me to read it out loud?
Please, don't mind.
I thought you might read it to myself. It is incumbent upon the Israeli nation engaging Torah and mitzvot for its own sake to qualify themselves and the people of the entire world until they develop to accept this high work of loving others, which is the ladder to the purpose of creation. Beautiful.
Beautiful.
Amen.
Beautiful indeed. Thank you so much, Itana. We really
thank you for inviting me.
We did not know what to expect, but now I feel like we have one more friend around the mountain, as Seth said. We invite everyone who listened, obviously, to like us, comment, share, subscribe, click on the bell to get notifications. We're live on Sunday, and we have a few great guests coming up for 2024. So be with us and continue to ask the big questions, and above all, love everybody. That's all we need. Funny as it sounds. So thank you, Tana. Seth, I'll see you very soon. And we're the Jew Function. We're out.
Thank you.
Thanks. Take care. Be well.